The following program is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
Seeing Red Radio.
Truth is, there's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
We carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations.
To protect the haves from the have-nots.
Freedom is the universal gift of Almighty God.
To maintain the security of those who accumulate wealth from the labor of others.
We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense.
To protect wealth from the poverty that wealth creates.
We will work with our friends and allies across the world to defend our way of life.
Corporate and political powers connive to keep wages down while shredding the worker's safety net.
A time comes when silence is betrayal.
Seeing Red Radio.
We can usher in a new era of enhanced prosperity and peace.
The great American wealth machine has been cranking out jackpots for the people at the top.
America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace.
And pushing working people further down the ladder.
Did our generation advance the cause of freedom?
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land. That it should be a collective ownership.
That time has come for us.
There comes a time when the operation of the machine is so odious.
I have been proud to be a part of a strong bipartisan consensus.
That you cannot even tacitly participate. You've got to place your bodies on the gears, the wheels, all the mechanism, and you've got to indicate to those who own it and those who run it that unless you are free, the machine will be prevented from working at all.
Welcome. You are listening to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a revolutionary socialist perspective. I'm your host, Anthony Udell. We believe another world is possible, and it is our project to make that world a reality. Welcome to the program. On this week's edition of Seeing Red Radio, we'll have a special presentation of a talk by Slavoj Žižek, the prominent Marxist intellectual, who spoke just a little less than a month ago at the Socialist Worker Party's annual summer conference called Marxism 2009. His talk, What Does It Mean to Be a Revolutionary Today? I hope you enjoy. Please stay tuned.
I would like to begin with Adorno, who, at the very beginning, again, of his three studies on Hegel, rejects this traditional patronizing question, what is still alive and what is dead in Hegel. According to Adorno, such a question presupposes an arrogant position of a judge who can graciously concede, yes, this is maybe still actual for us today. But Adorno points out, when we are dealing with a truly great philosopher, the question to be raised is not what can this philosopher tell us, but the opposite one. What are we, our contemporary situation, in his eyes? How would our epoch appear to his or her, of course, thought? And the same should be done with communism. Instead of asking the obvious stupid question, but is the idea of communism still pertinent today? Can it still be used as a tool for the analysis and political practice, one should ask, I think, the opposite question. How does our predicament today look from the perspective of the communist idea? This is the dialectic of the old and the new. It is those who propose almost every week new terms to grasp what is going on today. Postmodern society, risk society, post-industrial society, informational society. They, I think, miss what is really new. The only way to grasp what is new in the new is to analyze what goes on today through the lenses of what was eternal in the old. If communism is, to use Alain Badiou's term, an eternal idea, then it works as a Hegelian concrete universality. It is eternal not in the sense of a series of abstract features which can be applied to every situation, but in the sense that it has the ability, the potential, to be reinvented in each new historical situation. So, my first conclusion, to be true to what is eternal in communism, that is to say, to this drive towards radical emancipation which persists in the entire history from ancient times of Spartacus and so on. To keep this universal idea alive, one has to reinvent it again and again. And this holds especially today. In 1990, a certain epoch, the epoch of the 20th century communist struggle, was over. One should think to the end this rupture. One should lay the foundations for a new beginning. As Lenin put it, one should begin from the beginning again. All the nostalgia for 20th century, for state socialism, for social democratic welfare state, even, I claim, there is a little bit of this, all the nostalgia for councils, direct democracy, should be critically analyzed. Plus, I think we should drop the eternal temptation, especially of leftist intellectuals, nostalgia for another place where things are really happening. You know, in the 30s, 40s, it was, we may be in but things are really happening in Russia, which meant I can go on with my highly paid job at the university. My heart is really in Russia, but, you know. And today it goes the same. When I was young, it was China, it was Cuba. I'm afraid, although I may offend some among you, that today I see the same tendency which some people deal with Latin America, as if, oh my God, again, we can dream. No, our only help to Chavez and others is to be, when they deserve it, ruthlessly critical towards them. That's how we treat them seriously. Second point, to be a revolutionary, one should, it's very simple what I will say. I will be a little bit boring, I agree here with Alex, we should play a very naive game of simply defining how can you be a revolutionary today. The first thesis is that you should see the principal problem in capitalism itself. What does this mean? Not in technological reason, manipulation of nature, not in authoritarian politics, even not in racism or sexism, not in ecological threat, but in the totality of capitalism. Which means that, utopian as it may sound, and here I agree with what you already said, we should stick, utopian as it may sound, to the overcoming of capitalism as the ultimate goal. Not to capitalism with human face. As once we were dreaming about socialism with human face, let's be clear, most of the so-called left today plays the game of capitalism with a human face. Like a little bit better, a little bit more tolerant. That's not enough. This is the non-negotiable minimum of being a revolutionary communist today. Neither capitalism with human face, and this human face can have different, well, faces, no? More welfare state, more tolerance, whatever you want. Neither this, nor, this may be again problematic to some of you, nor return to any old authentic form. Even, now I will say something problematic, even if they are masked as anti-colonialist struggle. I mean, out of my respect, for example, for my Latino American friends, is that, you know, I don't buy that stuff off. In old Incas and Mayas, there were some forms of direct tribal democracy to which we should return. No, we should be absolutely modern. Utopian, so now comes my point. Utopian is not only the conservative dream of regaining some idealized past before the fall, not only the image of the bright future. No less utopian is the liberal pragmatic idea that we can solve problems gradually, one by one. You know, when we ask radical questions, the usual answer is, people are dying now in Rwanda, so forget about anti-imperialist struggle. Let us just prevent the slaughter there. Or, one has to find poverty and racism here and now. Let's forget those theological debates on global capitalism. Let's do something. People are starving and so on. How does this work? Let me quote a polemic by American, otherwise relatively, whatever this means in the United States, progressive leftist theologist John Caputo, who wrote critically of me and Badiou. I quote, I would be perfectly happy if the politicians in the United States were able to reform the system by providing universal health care, effectively redistributing wealth more equitably with a revised IRS code, effectively restricting campaign financing, enfranchising all voters, treating migrant workers humanely, and effecting a multilateral foreign policy that would integrate American power within the international community, and so on, and so on. That is to say, if they were to intervene upon capitalism by means of serious and far-reaching reforms. If, after doing all that, Badiou and Žižek complain that some monster called capital still stalks us, I would be inclined to greet that monster with a yawn. End of quote. The problem here is not Caputo's conclusion. If one can achieve all this within capitalism, why not remain in capitalism? The problem, I think, is the underlying utopian premise that it is possible to achieve all this within the coordinates of global capitalism. What if the particular malfunctionings of capitalism enumerated by Caputo are not accidental disturbances but structurally necessary? What if Caputo's dream is a dream of universality, the universal capitalist order, without its symptoms, without its critical points, in which its, as it were, repressed truth articulates itself? So again, I think that in a revolutionary situation, and I sincerely think, I will explain why we are approaching it, for me, I wonder if you, Alex, agree, one of the definitions of properly revolutionary situation is, if in ordinary times we can say, oh, you are utopian, let's do it piece by piece, in a revolutionary situation is a situation where precisely this realistic, pragmatic, step-by-step approach doesn't work, where this is the true utopia. This means what? This means that although we should fully participate in anti-racist, anti-sexist, and so on struggles, we should, in every tactical alliance with left liberals, of course, for example, if there are racist outbursts, and if honest liberals tell us we should together defend certain democratic values, of course we do it. But we should also question their complicity in this phenomena. Capitalism is a totality which itself generates phenomena like religious fundamentalism. For example, today media bombard us with Muslim fundamentalist threat. And then again, we are blackmailed by liberals. My God, you see there, women are circumcised or whatever, blah, blah. Isn't this a shared struggle? Of course, up to a point we should participate. But we should ask, nonetheless, a simple question. Where does this rise of so-called fundamentalism come? Is the rise of radical Islamism not exactly correlative to the disappearance of the secular left in Muslim countries? Today, when Afghanistan is portrayed as the utmost Islamic fundamentalist country, who still remember, I do, we are unfortunately old enough to remember, that 30, 40 years ago, who knows, it was a country with extremely strong secular tradition, up to a powerful communist party which took power there independently of the Soviet Union. So my point, we should always remind liberals of this. It's not some old ancient traditions which still persist, again, modernization. Afghanistan became, how should I put it, fundamentalized as part of its being included in the global capital. Its fundamentalization is a product. And it's the same in the United of being included in global capital. And as Thomas Frank has shown, the same goes, for example, for Kansas, the U.S. homegrown version of Afghanistan. The very state which was till 1970s, you should remember, don't laugh to me, that till 1970s, Kansas was the bedrock of radical leftist populism in the United States. The strongest already in the Civil War, before the Civil War, John Brown is from Kansas. All the leftist populist anti-racist struggle had their roots usually there. Today it's the bedrock of Christian fundamentalism. Does this not confirm again Walter Benjamin's thesis that every fascism is an index of a failed revolution? Next, now crucial point, the need to reinvent communism also means that it is not enough to stick to the communist idea. As already Alex pointed out, one should locate in our actual predicament tendencies which point in this direction. concrete antagonisms which cannot be resolved within the global capitalist space. Today's historical situation, I think, not only does not compel us to drop the notion of proletariat, on the contrary, it compels us to radicalize Marxist notion of the of a proletarian, the exploited worker whose product is taken away from him so that he is reduced to subjectivity without substance. It should be radicalized to an existential level well beyond Marxist imagination, to a subject reduced to the evanescent point almost of the Cartesian cogito, deprived of all substantial content. What is ecological crisis if not another form of proletarization? We are being deprived of the natural substance of our existence. What is all the struggle for intellectual property if not an attempt to deprive us of the symbolic substance of our lives? What are biogenetics manipulations if not an attempt to deprive us even of our genetic legacy, and so on? The same goes for slum dwellers and other living dead deprived of the most elementary conditions of life, even at the psychological level, the so-called post-traumatic subjects, the living dead, deprived of their substance. So I claim we should renovate Marx, not by making a compromise. Marx was too utopian, we should stay within capitalism, but by pushing his notion of proletarization even further. I'm almost tempted, shamelessly to say, as a materialist, to an apocalyptic level. I told this when he was here to Gianni Vattimo, and he advocated this weak communism, no? I told him, I agree with you only on condition that you admit that if communism is weak, it needs a strong army police protection, and so on. But where I agree with him is I am, let's say, a weak apocalyptic person. That is to say, I don't believe this tomorrow on asteroid would kill us. But frankly, I claim that a cold analysis of all these processes that I enumerated, ecology, biogenetics, and so on, slums, and so on, do they not all approach some kind of almost apocalyptic zero point? Ecological breakdown, biogenetic reduction of humans to manipulable machines, total digital control of over our lives, and so on, and so on. And there are many elements in our experience. Here we should start the analysis. This would be, for me, the beginning of being a communist today, to locate this dimensions of the ongoing proletarization. For example, just to give you two empirical detailed phenomena, food. What goes on the food market? We hear a lot about fight against drought and so on. It's a part of the aesthetic image of every big company from Starbucks downward to claim how when you buy their product, you help the poor to have more whatever. But what is less known is that something terrifying is silently going on. You know what are big companies and whole countries doing? Just to give you an idea of what is going on while we are not even aware of it. You know that as an answer to the ongoing economic and weather disturbances, you know that big countries, developed countries, are now serially buying or leasing for 99 years, getting control of large tracts of the most fertile land in third world countries, directly, in a way, recolonizing them. For example, I read recently that nearly half of all arable land in Madagascar was recently bought by a combination of South Korean companies, and so on and so on. I mean, new hungers are prepared here. Another thing, I don't have time to develop it, but another thing where should start the analysis is the problem of what happens with democracy. I claim that our strategy towards liberals shouldn't be this old Marxist game, oh, it's only a formal democracy or whatever, but don't they see how the tendency I see is not only the loss of, okay, more and more radical loss of substance of democracy, which is spreading from the east to the to the West, what is poetically called capitalism with Asian values. Forget Asia. I think it's a general tendency. Take Italy. I'm more and more convinced if you want to analyze Europe today, you should start with Italy, where you have somebody like Berlusconi, who is someone like, I would say, you know, Jack Nicholson, the Joker in Batman in power. Something is happening. We all laugh at him, but he is changing democracy into an empty performance. The left is totally breakdown. So the lesson here, our lesson to liberals should be, are you aware that without our radical leftist help, you will not be able even to protect what little we have of democracy, with all the ominous background of, I'm here consciously ironic, of the 68 Soviet intervention in Czechoslovakia. Liberals should be aware that they need our brotherly help, as they put it, to save their own ideals. Only we can save them. But as you pointed out, the situation is critical. Why? Yes, capitalism doesn't work, a crisis, and so on. But to refer to Naomi Klein, you know, there is always a danger, and more than a danger, that crisis can be used as a shock therapy, even to ideologically reinforce the system. But just to conclude, nonetheless, I think I want to finish with an anecdote and then with a final short story. We can count on unexpected allies in this struggle. The fate of, maybe some of you, if you are old enough, know the name, Viktor Kravchenko, the Soviet diplomat who, in 1944, while in New York, defected to the West and then wrote a famous best-selling memoir, I Chose Freedom, is worth mentioning here. This book is the first substantial report on the horrors of Stalinism, beginning with a detailed account of the forced collectivization and mass hunger in Ukraine, where Kravchenko himself participated in enforcing collectivization. But now comes the mystery. The publicly known story about Kravchenko ends in 1949 when he triumphantly won the big trial against his Soviet accusers in Paris, who brought to court even his ex-wife to testify to his corruption, alcoholism, and so on and so on. So that's what is publicly known about Kravchenko, the Cold War Western icon, the first great anti-communist. But what is much less known is that immediately after this victory, when Kravchenko was hailed all around the world as a Cold War hero, he got deeply worried about the McCarthy anti-communist witch hunt and issued warnings that such a way to fight Stalinism courts the danger of starting to resemble its opponent. He also became more and more aware of the injustices of the Western world. And after writing a much less known sequel to I Chose Freedom, significantly entitled I Chose Justice, nobody talks about this book, Kravchenko engaged in a crusade to find a new, less exploitative mode of the organization of production. This led him, it's deeply symbolic, to Bolivia, where in the late 50s he put and lost all the money he earned from his anti-communist bestseller into organizing poor farmers into new collectives. Crushed by the failure of his endeavors, he withdrew into private life and shot himself in the early 60s, suicide in his home in New York. His suicide was due to his despair, not to some dark KGB blackmail, a proof that Kravchenko's denunciation of the Soviet Union was a genuine communist act of protest against injustice. We need people like this, people who, you know, being for the enemy, go through and see where they stand, where we stand. In the good old days, now comes the dirty conclusion, I warn you, it's really dirty. In the good old days of really existing socialism, a joke was popular among dissidents, a joke used to illustrate the futility of their protests. In the 15th century Russia, occupied by Mongols, that's the joke, a farmer and his wife walk along a dusty country road. A Mongol warrior on a horse stops at their side and tells the farmer that he will now rape his wife. He then adds, "But since there is a lot of dust on the ground, you should hold my testicles while I'm raping your wife so that they will not get dusty, dirty." After the Mongol finishes his job and rides away, the farmer starts to laugh and jump with joy. The surprised wife asks him, "How can you be jumping with joy when I was just brutally raped?" The farmer answers, "But I got him. His balls are full of dust." This sad joke tells of the predicament of dissidents. They thought they were dealing serious blows to the party nomenclatura, but all they were doing were, well, getting a little bit of dust on the nomenclatura's testicles. Is today's critical left all too often not in a similar position? We think we are doing something terribly subversive. We are just... Our task is to discover how to make a step further. Our thesis 11 today should be: critical leftists have hitherto only dirtied with dust the balls of those in power. The point is to cut them off.
This economy has been taken under siege by an industry that's been dictated militarily. Deepened in on oil, under foreign soil, like a locomotive waiting to feel the water boil. We are a proletariat that has can't stand without foundation, even though you bury it.
Even though you bury it.
And even though my hand prepared food you eat, you wouldn't stop to shake it if you saw me on the street. And we haven't changed a thing since 1944. Let us disband an office, make a killing with the war. Guarantee a build a better bomb. If Uncle Sam will guarantee a paycheck every month. Brothers in the infantry so he can go to college after his fourth and final tour.
Just one more tour.
One more tour. Against my people.
And that's the Cobra Skulls with "There's a Military Industrial Skeleton in My Closet." You're listening to Seeing Red Radio. Now please stay tuned. We'll return to the talk that you've been hearing by Slavoj Žižek from Marxism 2009, entitled "What Does It Mean to Be a Revolutionary Today?"
I see this is what Hegel calls concrete universality, all particular historical forms of capitalism as a way trying to mask, conceal, resolve, postpone this basic antagonism. And within this, it's easy to define the difference. What fascism tries to do, again, without antagonistic struggle, how capitalism with a human face tries to do, and so on and so on. Second question, what does it mean to do nothing today? Well, one thing to do nothing would be not to give banks anything and so on. I think the result would be exactly the same. But nonetheless, beware, what do I say in the book? I don't say let's do nothing. I say sometimes doing nothing is the most violent thing to do. What I try to draw attention to is what? Everybody who knows me knows that I'm obsessional neurotic. What does this mean? Obsessional neurotic is active all the time, not in order to achieve something, but just to keep things the same. Like I remember when I was in psychoanalysis, I was talking all the time like crazy to my analyst. Why? Because I didn't want anything to change. I wanted to make it sure that if I talk all the time, the analyst will not even have time to ask me an embarrassing question too. I claim that often with our critical activity, blah, blah, we are hyperactive just to make it sure that nothing will change, how should I put it? And sometimes when all of a sudden, you know, you do nothing, there is a kind of an ominous moment of awareness. Then that problem, a nice question about how to collaborate with liberals, bad faith, and so on. I'm sorry if I gave the impression that I was dealing with politics of this kind of a communist suspicion in the popular front. On the opposite, we should, when we have, for example, racist struggle, we should be absolutely 100% solidary. It's not like we are up to you liberals to a certain point, but we have our class struggle reserve or whatever. Our message to liberals should be, we know what you want if you are anti-racist, and we are more what you want to be than you yourself are. I didn't mean this kind of compromising, we are not fully against racism, but for example, we are able to show a liberal to detect racism where he will not be aware. Let me, so that I don't lose time, a wonderful thing that, wonderful in the sense of analysis, otherwise horrible happened. In the United States, some 3-4 years ago, maybe you remember it was widely reported in the media, I think it was this Cambridge, Boston, Massachusetts University, an Indian couple from India, not Native Americans, high-paid programmers, and there was, you remember, she was celebrated in England, an English nanny, who, I think, by neglect, caused their death. You know, here it was reported, totally, all my American friends told me that British nanny was extremely popular because it was perceived as a displaced class issue. Those rich Indian, upper class, multicultural, and so on, and here is an ordinary working class girl who now, for doing the hard work, gets screwed, and so on, and so on. This is my first interesting point here. To what extent feminist struggle, multicultural struggle, and so on are, how should I put it, are over-determined by a class dimension. So to me, the problem is not so much to convince liberals. It's much more difficult, that's the harshest struggle today, to convince working class, which is fundamentalist and so on. Let me be brutally clear to provoke maybe a reaction. You know, sometimes when I read leftist analysis, it is as if anti-immigrant politics is some kind of a, I don't know, imperialist invention to screw ordinary people. No, sorry, it's mostly, not so spontaneous, but nonetheless, it's a typically working class, working class, spontaneous, ideological working class reaction, which then allows upper classes to be multiculturalist, open, and so on, and so on, and so on. Things are more complex here. Okay, Norway question. The tyranny of decency. This is a very, I'm so sad I don't have time to develop it because I'm almost tempted to go into the defense of decency. I think those old times where bourgeois, high bourgeois were decent and working class was vulgar, I think they are over. I think the elites are today more and more vulgar and so on. But it's, again, against state, the question of state. No, I think that what we should also question, if there is a lesson, it's the big opposite of state, as I hinted. I think we should drop this myth that, you know, every form of state mediation is bad and we need some kind of a council-direct democracy. Let's face it, you cannot organize entire society in this way. This is a problem. Now, the question of, I'm coming to the end. Yeah. How to cut, now it's again, you should allow me this one. How to cut off the balls, no? You know, okay, I will not be tasteless, but I will a little bit tasteless to go. Of course, there are different modalities. Maybe the illusion of 20th century was that you grab them and directly cut them. But I think there are different ways. I agree here with the idea that maybe, sometimes precisely small measures function. Like you say, oh, we don't want to cut your balls, we will just help them to thrive better with small reforms, and then everybody is happy, and then all of a sudden the capitalists look down, where are my balls, Kausterburg? You know what I mean? Like, it's not, the problem is maybe not the big act, cut the balls, but you make small changes, and all of a sudden, balls are no longer there. Iran. I'm sad we didn't have more time. I fully agree with you, Alex, that Iran is a, you know what made me so sad about Iran? How? Not only, the whole field is so mystified. The majority in the West played this Bernard-Henri Lévy game, oh, Western reformers taking over. On the opposite side, some paranoiac left played the game of, this is all CIA plot, and so on and so on. But the crucial insight, and I have many links in Iran, I wasn't totally bluffing, the crucial insight is that Mousavi is not a pro-Western reformist. Neither a cleric. It's the whatever was authentic in the revolution. And if we are not able to recognize that, it's sad for us. Just to conclude, really, about I think when people are asked, but what you are dreaming about, what revolution and so on, we should emphasize more and more. My God, I really think we are. Let's not kid ourselves. We are slowly approaching. We live in apocalyptic times. It cannot go on indefinitely the way it goes now, for ecological reasons, for other reasons, and so on and so on. So I don't have this kind of obsessional problems. Oh my God, what if capitalism will just go on and so on? It will not. Our strategy should be, it cannot go on. And if we don't act now, the choice is not relatively, in spite of the crisis, functioning capitalism or communism. No. The problem is that if things are let to their own run, we will awaken in a new half, like Berlusconi turned half crazy dictator. We will awaken all of a sudden in a terrifying society, and that's on what we should insist. So that I don't have this kind of a problem. What if things go on relatively happy? Who will be for a revolution? The true danger I see if things are left to themselves, there will be a catastrophe. That's my pessimistic view. Thank you very much.
Get off my back, Mr. Bossman. Pushing me like you wanna push me out of my job, Mr. Bossman. Stop pushing me like you wanna push me out of my job, Mr. Bossman. I've got 2 kids and a wife, working for to keep them alive in this time. Without me working for them, they will drop down and starve for hungry. Mr. Bossman, get off my back, sir. Stop pushing me, like you wanna push me out on the street. Mr. Bossman, stop pushing me, like you wanna push me out of a job. Mr. Bossman, it seems like you wanna push me out to steal from the poor people on the street. I don't wanna do that, sir. I prefer work for my living, work for my health and strength day by day. So stop pushing me, like you wanna push me out of a job, sir. Mr. Bossman, please have some sympathy and me, sir. Mr. Big Bossman, stop pushing me, like you wanna push me out of my job, sir. Mr. Bossman, reason why. Working for to keep them alive in this time. Without me, sir, they will starve and drop down for angry. So stop pushing me, pushing me, pushing me, like you wanna push me out of my job, Mr. Boss Man. Get off my back, sir. Every time I go on lunchtime, you keep pushing me, pushing me, pushing me, like you wanna push me out of my job, Mr. Boss Man. Get off my back, sir.
Welcome to another production of Eurocentric One. Oh my God, I know I will get boos for this and so on, but I claim that, I will say something horrible, consciously. I claim that in order to be truly radically, you have to go in some way through a very violent process of what I would say this Cartesian subjectivity and so on, which is... it was first a European process. I think that the only way to universality is through modernization, which was capitalist European modernization. It's horrible. I know I'm ready to be accused of racism and so on. I think that it's time for us leftists not to be afraid of what is great in European legacy. The greatest moment of modernity, there is nothing to be ashamed of. Modernity is not just slavery. Modernity is when Descartes says, the beginning of my philosophy was, first I was an idiot and laughed at others, other cultures. Then I asked myself, but what if my customs are in the same way idiotic for the others' view, and so on and so on. This is the beginning of modernity, European modernity, to experience your own cultural background as something ultimately contingent, irrelevant, and so on. I know it has its limitations and so on, but to fight them it's even through even more radically being that. Socialism in Poland and all those countries. Well, I can tell you, not so bad. Recently, the danger is almost the opposite one, that because of the recent troubles, large strata of population even have some wrong, misleading nostalgia for real socialist system. Like there was a recent opinion poll where over one third of each Germans preferred the wall and so on and so on. So it's more complex. It's no longer, absolutely no longer true that East Europeans are simply against socialism because they knew what it is and so on and so on. State, I think nonetheless, you know, my God, let's be realistic here. I am ready, yes, I agree with both with the whole idea of we should be ultimately against the state, but I totally agree with what Alex said, we should ruthlessly use power. The whole wager of communist revolutionaries is that you can make state work against itself, how should I put it. But nonetheless, my God, now I will be a modest British empiricist. Aren't there some problems here? Do we really know how to move outside state and so on? Let's just admit that we don't have even a clear idea, apart from this, you know, self-association of free people and so on, how to do this. Then I will be a very brief. This question of spontaneity, working class, and so on. I'm afraid we don't have time. This would have been a real debate. I'm a little bit more pessimist here. Pessimist in the sense that, my God, look, let's look at the history of anti-Semitism. You know that... if you look when it started in 11th, 12th century, it was unfortunately from below. And this is not in any way to dismiss or to make fun of so-called lower classes or whatever, but this is the tremendous force of ideology exerted on people in desperate situations and so on. Do you know, for example, that when violent anti-Semitism started, that Pope and the king tried to control it, but it explodes. So it's a much more complex phenomenon. Don't fall into this trap. The worst favor you can do to real workers is to make them into this kind of a naive, good idiots manipulated by some, you know, I'm more scared. So just now, the most problematic point, here I would like really to be clear. And I stand by my joke. I will try to explain you why. The bad taste, joke, whatever, rape. I thought well in advance, should I use the joke or not? The first reason I did is that at least if you read the content, it's not in any way making fun of or, you know, in any way against the raped woman. It's on the contrary, my God. The structure of the joke is that the so-called progressive intellectual, in order to score his small narcissistic point, oh, I dusted the balls, totally ignores the suffering there. That's the whole point of the joke. And now you can still say, so it's precisely, that's the whole point. Now, to go even a step further, now you will say, I know, and you have the right to say this, but nonetheless, the topic is rape. Obviously, horrible suffering was going on there, and nonetheless, we laughed. My experience from real struggles, friends in Sarajevo, is, yes, that's what you should do. My God, I have friends in Sarajevo who were shot, raped, and how they survived. Do you know that when Sarajevo was under siege, this was the golden era of incredibly brutal, cruel jokes. I spoke with women who were raped, and they told me the only way to survive is not to say, oh, I'm now a victim, but to turn her predicament into a dirty joke, and so on and so on. I mean, that's real life. I'm not bluffing here. This is not intellectual stuff. What I wanted to avoid is an anecdote which something that happened to me. I reported in my Hitchcock book, I immediately read, where during the war in Yugoslavia, I was in California on a Hitchcock conference, 92, and somebody attacked me. How dare you talk about such trifling things like Alfred Hitchcock when your country is in flames? I exploded. So he can, I cannot. I am allowed, being from ex-Yugoslavia, only what? To play the victim and report on my suffering and so on, and they can. No, I told him, let's change roles. I want to talk about Hitchcock, you talk about my suffering and so on. I mean, it is so important to, how to put it, I sincerely apologize, I'm not bluffing. If it was taken like you know, but ha-ha, nonetheless, a woman is raped and we laugh. But I sincerely believe, otherwise I would kill myself, that it can be done in a deep solidarity. Because I think what I admire, I met women who are raped, is that with all the pain and so on, you know, they don't play the victim, they retain the insolence and so on. They are speaking about cutting the balls and so on, no? The woman should be given a knife there too. Like, while the guy was worrying about dust, the woman should have cut them off. No.
Try.
listening to Seeing Red Radio. Tonight we heard a talk by prominent Marxist intellectual Slavoj Žižek, the first part of a debate that he had with Alex Kalinikos at the Socialist Workers' Party annual summer conference, Marxism 2009, which happened just a little less than a month ago. Please tune in next week when we present the second part, Alex Kalinikos's What It Means to Be a Revolutionary Today. If you're interested in seeing the videos of both of those talks, as well as others, please check out the Seeing Red Radio website at seeingredradio.org. You can also look up the music that you heard this evening, as well as download past episodes and subscribe to future episodes through our podcast. That's at seeingredradio.org. Thanks again for tuning in. We'll see you next week. Solidarity.
Macht auf, verdammte diese Erde, die stets mal noch zum Hungern zwingt. Das Recht, die Blut im Kater Herde, nun mit Macht zum Durchbruch bringt. Reinen Tisch, mach mit den Bedrängern, her der Sklaven. Nicht länger, alles zu werden, strömt zu auf. Völker, hört die Signale, auf zum letzten Gefecht. Die Internationale erkennt das Menschenrecht. Völker, hört die Signale, auf zum Wesen, kein Gott, kein Kaiser noch Tribun, uns aus dem Elend zu erlösen, können wir nur selber tun. Leeres Wort des armen Rechte, leeres Wort des reichen Pflicht, unmündig nennt man uns und Knechte, du lebt wie schwach nun länger nicht. Signale auf zum letzten Gefecht. Die Internationale erkennt das Menschenrecht. Völker, hört die Signale auf zum letzten Gefecht. Arbeitsleute, wir sind die Stärksten der Partei. Die müßig Denker schiebt beiseite, diese Welt muss unser sein. Unser Blut sei nicht mehr der Raben und der Nächten Geier Fass. Erst wenn wir sie vertrieben haben, erscheint die Sonne ohne Unterlass. Das Menschen.
following is closed captioned for the thinking impaired.
I do not believe that a few people should control the wealth of any land, that it should be a collective ownership.
There's been a class war waged in America for 30 years now, from the top down, and the rich have won.
I prescribe the treatment of a radical revolution within our nation from that of a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented community.
Revolution is rapid transformation of the political and or social and economic system.
A world run by a handful of greedy bankers and CEOs who nobody elected can't possibly love.
It's critically important to ensure that the huge profits, profits beyond the dream of avarice, that they go into the right pockets.
This is a long-term battle, war. But this is long-term. After all, our mission is terrorism.
Terrorism is not done cheaply, and funds will be required.
Do you now have a better estimate of when American forces can come home from Iraq?
No, but that's not too important.
The question is, can we use our military power wisely? Can we be strategic in terms of how we move forward?
If I'm the president, we will attack Iran.
Two-thirds of Americans say it's not worth fighting.
So?
So? You don't care what the American people think?
No.
Time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us.
And no matter how long it takes, we will defeat freedom.
Tune in to Seeing Red Radio, the radio show with a Marxist perspective, every Thursday at 8 p.m. right here on Valley Free Radio, WXOJLP.
Fellow citizens, your enemy is ruling your country,
and war is what they got.
We have a common enemy. We have this in common. We have a common oppressor, a common exploiter.
And remember what the elder Frederick Douglass taught us. The power concedes nothing without a demand.